Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, December 28th, and this is our special year-end news roundup. Today, we're going to look back at the year in the news and discuss some of the top local news stories of 2018. Joining me in the studio from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. Good morning, Patrick.
Good morning, Steve.
Patrick, one of the biggest stories of 2018 was the tragic killing of Yarmouth police officer Sean Gannon. This happened on April 12th. It was a Thursday afternoon. I think a lot of people felt a sense of disbelief as this story started to come out. It just didn't seem like something that would happen here.
Exactly, and that's what everybody was saying. You know, it happened here. They didn't think it could ever happen here. Sean Gannon was an officer at the time. He was posthumously promoted to sergeant. He was a canine officer. He was helping to serve a search warrant, arrest warrant, really, on a Thomas Latanowicz at this home in Marston's Mills. And they went into the home, they searched the home at first, and this is all according to prosecutors and police, at first they didn't find Latanowicz, and there was apparently a noise of some sort from, I believe, the attic, and Gannon and others went to search the attic, and apparently while they were up there searching, Gannon pulled away a piece of insulation that led into another part of the attic, and that's where allegedly Latanowicz was and where he ended up firing the shot that killed Gannon. He also wounded Gannon's canine partner, mm-hmm. who was there, Nero, and Nero was actually left in the attic with Latanowicz for a time. They basically withdrew. They pulled Gannon out. He was later declared dead at the hospital, and Nero was in the attic with Latanowicz, and eventually they were able to get Latanowicz out and get Nero out. Nero has since recovered, but this was something that struck the community incredibly hard. The entire Cape, Yarmouth, obviously is a police department with strong ties to the community, and they really see themselves as a community police department. They're always parts of events and parts of the community. So when this happened to them, it was, you know, all the more so something that struck a chord with everybody across the Cape who was used to seeing Yarmouth officers involved in so many things. There was an outpouring of support, certainly for the funeral, the wake, and the funeral the next week. Mm-hmm. Seas of police and law enforcement and other officials, fire departments from across the state, across the country, really came out for those services. And it raised a lot of questions. And the questions were primarily focused on why Thomas Latanowicz, a man with a long, long criminal mm-hmm. record, and the numbers kind of changed over time. We had done some research and found, you know, a lot. It doesn't really matter. At first, they were more than 100 charges that they said were against him, but we had done some research and he had 75 prior charges, some with carrying as many as 26 counts. Drug, guns, violent attacks were common threads throughout these.
Initially, the police wouldn't even refer to him by name in public statements. They referred to him by a number, 125, which they suggested was the number of these prior criminal charges that were against him, simply to indicate that this guy had such a long record.
Exactly. And by not referring to him as name, they certainly didn't want to give him their goal was not to give him the notoriety that they didn't think he deserved anything, obviously. And we took a look, a hard look. Our reporter Kristen Young took a hard look at that criminal history and how he was out at this time. And it was entirely not black and white. The criminal justice system is at best difficult to understand sometimes. There were issues where he had threatened people and so they wouldn't testify against him. He was paroled early at one point. There were times when prosecutors didn't feel like they had enough evidence or the judge didn't feel like he had enough evidence to convict him or put him away. He was put away for some time. But looking at that, I mean, the one thing that became clear is that it wasn't easy to look at this and say why exactly he was out at the time. Also, fixes to the system, which police at the time were saying was broken, and emotionally in some respects, but also they had been looking at, you know, the criminal justice system, and there had been some reforms recently at the state level, and arguing that it was broken and that judges were making wrong decisions. There was a lot of anger in the immediate aftermath about kind of the decisions that judges were making. But as we spoke to more and more people, it did become clear that this is a system that's very complicated and in some ways is rightfully, according to prosecutors and attorneys, a system that's, you know, it it shouldn't be easy to put somebody away because you don't want to put away the wrong person. You don't want to put away somebody who's innocent. Again, in this case, Latinovich became, I think for a lot of people, the poster child of somebody who had a long criminal history, somebody who had proven himself to be violent in the past. And he was arrested and charged with murder and charged with interfering, I think was the technical term, with a police dog. And is facing those charges currently, and that case is proceeding. It seems, again, for a lot of people, pretty open and shut case. Again, he was there. There were a lot of police who immediately surrounded the home during the standoff that ensued after the shooting. But again, it's important to point out that for the community and for Sean Gannon's family, for his loved ones, this was obviously a tragedy. His parents have been vocal and have taken some interesting stances that don't always line up exactly with a lot of the supporters of harsher measures for criminals. And it's been interesting to see that kind of conversation play out. And there have been things that have happened since then at the legislative level.
I think we should take a moment to talk about Sean Gannon as a young officer. I think part of the story that affected so many people as well, not only the tragic death of a police officer, but Sean Gannon, a very young man with a young wife here on the Cape, both of them really involved in the community and seen as being representing something of the younger community that's so valuable here on the Cape.
Absolutely. His wife, Dara, as you said, was very involved in working with nonprofits and doing things within the community. Sean Gannon was known as somebody who was always willing to put himself out there and be involved in community policing. He did some things that, you know, when police officers are looking at tasks that they should do, I think the chief had said he took on some things that you wouldn't normally want to do if you were really only thinking about forwarding your career in a certain direction. He was again doing things that were not necessarily, well, not at all self-serving.
He was a big brother program.
Absolutely, and they came out certainly and were hurt by this, obviously. But he was somebody who, as you said, represented a younger generation of police and maybe a generation of police that was looking at things a little differently than the older generation. And I think that struck everybody, including some of those older police officers who realized that this was a young man who was going to go very far in the department and perhaps beyond.
Another big story of 2018, another tragedy, was the Cape's first shark fatality. This was in mid-September on a Wellfleet beach.
Yeah, and this was a young man, Arthur Medici. He's a 26-year-old man from Revere. This happened on September 15th. It was exactly a month after another man, a New York neurologist and professor, William Layton, had been bitten by a great white shark and survived. He had been bitten on another beach, but he survived those injuries. And, you know, we had had a man who was bitten, a man from Colorado who was bitten some number of years back. But Medici's death was, as you said, the first shark attack that led to a death in, I think, 80 years or something along those lines. So going way back. But everybody who looked at the shark population here on the Cape and around the Cape, the great white shark population, kind of said this was inevitable. Mm-hmm. I mean, that you have a burgeoning seal population, and you have following on that within the last decade or so a great white shark population that has started to return and return in larger and larger numbers. And these are big, powerful animals. And in Medici's case, again, he was bodyboarding, so he was, you know, doing something that puts you in a position, especially on those Atlantic coast beaches, where you are within the territory of these animals. But it, in other respects, he was doing it at a time of day.
He was doing what they say you should do. He was in the midday. He was not that far off the beach.
It was low tide, I believe, at the time. And so he was kind of following all the suggestions that the National Park Service and others have put out in terms of trying to avoid an attack of this sort. They say don't go at dusk, don't go at dawn, don't swim too far out. There was some question about how far out he was at first. The officials were saying 30 yards. Other people said it was only 30 feet. So, you know, I think in those areas you have shallows, and distinguishing how far somebody is out is sometimes difficult. But those areas are also, it should be pointed out, down cliffs and on these wide, long beaches where getting back to the parking lot or even getting cell phone service is an ordeal. I mean, these are areas that are out there. I know the superintendent for the seashore has said this is really a wild place. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can think about this as bears in Yellowstone sort of thing, which people who come to the Cape and go to the beaches, for many years, I don't think thought that way. Again, there's other dangers, riptides, undercurrents, you know, all sorts of things that can happen to you. But sharks for many, many years wasn't one of those dangers as far as people are concerned. And certainly for the surfing community in particular, this was something that really hit home because they were still out there surfing regularly. And while some people may have changed their behaviors, they really feel comfortable in the water and they even feel comfortable seeing sharks around them. But in this case, it was somebody who, you know, it was, again, a beautiful day and you know, he did everything right, apparently, and he still was bitten and died. They say he may have bled out right there in the water. So raised a lot of questions, and mm-hmm. there have been a lot of meetings since then. A lot of people have been talking about what to do. There's been talk about culling seals. There have been talk about culling the sharks themselves. Both very uphill battles. The seals are protected by the Marine Mammal Protection Act, a federal law that would be very difficult to overturn. The sharks are also protected. And so to do that, at least close to shore, would be very difficult. So there's other things that people are looking at, including the use of drones, the use of different types of surveillance to try and see the sharks before they get to people. The Atlantic White Shark Conservancy, which has been working with Greg Skomo, the state scientist who's the, kind of the primary guy when it comes to these comes to sharks, you know, has been doing a lot of research. They just ended this year a 5-year population study, and they're going to be having the results of that population study coming up. But Skomo's already said up to 1,000 of these great white sharks over the last 5 years may have visited our areas. And these are, again, 14, 15-foot animals. And
they're seeing an uptick in younger sharks when they're doing these tagging programs, which suggests that there's a population that may be growing up around here.
Absolutely. And interesting enough, again, on the Atlantic coast side, you see some of the larger sharks. I think a lot of the smaller sharks, the younger great whites, are being seen in Cape Cod Bay. So even when you look at places like Brewster and Orleans and places where people aren't, they're like, oh, it's the flats, and it shallows out very quickly, and we're not worried about sharks. They're showing up there. They're, mm-hmm. They are absolutely in those areas. They're taking fishermen's fish off their hooks, and they're smaller sharks that are, again, going after striped bass and other fish versus the larger sharks who are more prone to go after the seals and the larger prey. But they're really all around us at this point, and I think people are coming to that realization. They're trying to figure out what to do with it. There's actually a regional meeting that's being planned. It was supposed to maybe happen towards the end of December, not going to happen at this point, or the beginning of next year, where legislators are starting to take, and the governor's office is starting to take a harder look at this. But the towns, the National Seashore, are trying to figure out, can we put drones up in the air? Can we do things? They're testing out different technologies to figure out if they can do something to alert people quicker to the presence of sharks and to respond when something happens. Stop the bleed programs and better cell phone coverage. All of these things are being discussed. Everything's really on the table. Nothing's happening too fast, but I think a lot of people are starting to worry about tourism industry, starting to worry about the prolonged effects of this type of situation.
It really does seem to represent a mindset shift for the Cape in a large way, because you think about everything the Cape represents, and having sharks, a potential shark attack happen in the middle of the summer is just something that is really a reset for how we think of ourselves.
I think it is true, but it is also important to point out that there are a lot of people out there who say, listen, that's their territory, and you know, it's actually a sign of a good environment when you have these larger predators in the water. It's cold comfort, I think, for the Medici family, certainly, and for other folks who are concerned about their safety.
This is our special year-end news roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. We'll have more in a moment. Welcome back. This is our special year-end news roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of 2018. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. Patrick, one of the stories this year we talked about almost every week, it seemed like, was the coming of legalized marijuana. And this falls under two parts. There's medical marijuana and recreational marijuana. And at the start of 2018, we didn't have any legal marijuana sales on the Cape. That changed this year in April.
And then changed back, because we did have an issue with the sole medical marijuana facility being shut down because of some concerns about mm-hmm. pesticides. We talked about that quite a bit last week. But the fact is that these marijuana shops are coming to the Cape. Again, it was a slow rollout to start with for the medical marijuana facilities, and a slow rollout for the recreational facilities. But it seems like now that they've gotten going last week, the shop in Ware Wareham opened, so that is right over the bridges, if you will. But the Cape landscape, if you will, for marijuana is pretty interesting because largely the towns that have chosen to move forward with allowing recreational marijuana in any case are on the Outer Cape. We're talking Provincetown, Truro, Wellfleet, and the towns kind of further in towards the bridges, with the exception of Mashpee, have really gone in the other direction and have instituted bans. Brewster went back and forth a little bit. Bourne, there was confusion about how that played out in terms of a ban on again, recreational marijuana facilities. Marijuana in the state, according to state law, is legal. So you can possess it. You can have a certain number of plants in your home. But these are really retail facilities that are selling it officially. On the Outer Cape, it also has to do with cultivation. And we're talking about a group of Truro farmers who have a cooperative that they've put together. And this was really a part of the law that was pushed by Outer Cape legislators as well. So you can see the kind of landscape settling in where you have some cultivation in the Truro Wellfleet area. You have in Provincetown, where this is an extraordinarily open community, you know, as far as all sorts of things. They're talking about seven, people who are looking to open shops in a very small area. And then you have Mashpee, which has the sole medical marijuana dispensary, but is also still open to recreational marijuana. Otherwise, the rest of the Cape, as far as recreational marijuana, has essentially instituted bans.
And the islands have their own challenge here because transportation across water is still, that's a federal area, or over in the air if you're flying.
Absolutely. Through the FAA or through the Coast Guard, you're in an area where it is certainly federally prohibited. Something that is even recently in the last couple of weeks being discussed in terms of the federal government changing its tune about that, which is really going to be interesting to see, and is not unusual as states start to approve a certain use or a certain thing that has otherwise been prohibited in the past. There's a certain breaking point where the federal government finally realizes that this is a nationwide issue that has to be dealt with national laws, and so the federal government seems to be coming along slowly.
And this is not just about smoking marijuana. There's a whole industry that's looking to come up to create other products that could be sold at shops.
Absolutely. And you're talking about tinctures. You're talking about all manners of products, edibles. And there are a lot of concerns, quite honestly, with a lot of that in terms of access for young people and whether or not it's going to be more accessible for young people and whether there might be the danger of a young person accidentally eating a gummy or a bear or something that is has marijuana in it that's being sold at some of these shops. Certainly with vaping being a very popular thing among young people, I don't think young people are actually using as much marijuana. They're more vaping nicotine, which is a concern that a lot of people are having. But the ability to basically smoke, it's not really smoking because you're not burning it, marijuana in public has become a question, and whether it should be allowed at beaches. A lot of these towns already have rules in place that don't allow that. Driving is a big issue, and that's something that the police are looking at. A lot of people quickly point out that marijuana was here before. It's not as if all of a sudden there's marijuana where there wasn't marijuana before. But certainly now that it's been legalized at the state level, law enforcement officials are looking at things like drugged driving and trying to figure out how they could determine if somebody was drugged at the time or on marijuana at the time that they were driving and there was a crash or they were pulled over. And one of the issues there is certainly that it stays in your system for a month. So say that you were in a crash and you had smoked 20 days earlier, you're right, completely sober, and they use that as they do a blood test or something and they can tell that you have marijuana in your system. You know, that's an interesting and strange place to be in terms of legality. You can say, I was sober, but it's still in your system. I think law enforcement is still very much trying to work a lot of these things out. And a lot of law enforcement was against the legalization, and now they're actually trying to kind of figure out how to deal with it. But for a lot of people, it is a business opportunity, and certainly a lot of people say if you have a problem with marijuana, you should look at alcohol and the problems with alcohol, which is perfectly legal and accepted by a lot of people.
And you can imagine looking back at the end of 2019, this is a story that's going to have changed again quite radically over the next year.
Absolutely. We will have, I'm sure, marijuana facilities open on the Cape for recreational sales.
The Steamship Authority figured in the news quite a bit this year as it dealt with an unprecedented number of ferry cancellations due to mechanical issues. This started up in the late winter, early spring, and it just seemed to keep going once it got started.
Yeah, and these issues range. We were talking about ferries running aground for various reasons. We were talking about ferries, what they were calling blacking out, where they lost power in various ways, and hundreds and hundreds of cancellations. And the traveling public was very unhappy about this. This is the way that people get back and forth in large part. They can fly as well, but the ferries are kind of the traditional way that a lot of people normally get back if they're not in an extreme rush to the islands. But even they can do it pretty quickly in a lot of respect on these ferries, and people are used to this. This is like taking a bus for most of these people is getting on one of these ferries. And I think they've felt comfortable doing that over the years. But these problems that cropped up in the early part of this year were problems that caused a lot of people a lot of angst. They're called the lifeline to the islands, and to even have the possibility that that lifeline was failing or not working really raised a lot of concerns. And the ferry line, the Steamship Authority, is kind of this has this traditional bent in terms of how it deals with things, and they certainly are worried about their budget quite a bit. This came out in a report issued late this year, just this month, about the problems, and this consultant saying that they were frugal, essentially to a fault, and they should be spending more money in order to address some of these problems. The ferry line says, hey, listen, we believe this was an anomaly. We believe this is kind of the perfect storm, if you will, to use an overused phrase, but of things that happened. And we don't think that this type of thing will happen again in the future. That being said, they are taking steps, they've said, to try and prevent any repeat of this, and also to kind of have a better communications plan in place to see how they can better inform people and keep them up to date on what's going on. So again, during these problems this year, really the major problems, nobody was injured. There was the Iano crash from a year and a half or so ago in Hyannis, and there were 15 people injured in that.
Which this report didn't even look at.
This report was not focused on that. It was really focused on these events earlier this year, and that was it. The Iano report, the Steamship Authority has already come out with its version of events. We're still waiting for the U.S. Coast Guard to issue their report about what happened with that. But that report that the consultant again issued this month, some of the phrases used were pretty interesting. Penny pinching, penny wise and pound foolish. I mean, they were really focused on the fact that the Steamship Authority has prided itself on kind of running a tight ship, tight budget, if you will. But they said that's been at the expense of kind of putting in place standards and practices and training that's really needed to avoid some of these problems. So again, the Steamship Authority will be dealing with this going forward, but it was a rough ride for them this year.
And the report is calling for $1 million. The improvements it's calling for could cost about $1 million a year, is what the report says.
Yep.
And that's money that you can expect will come out of the ridership.
Yeah, $1 million up front is what they're saying, and then $1 million in the operating budget every year. The Steamship Authority hasn't said that they're going to spend that money. It should be made clear. They've said we're going to look at these suggestions and we're going to figure out what should be implemented and what shouldn't be implemented. They're going through building a new terminal here in Woods Hole, so they have capital projects that are going on. But we'll have to see how they react in the long term to this.
They've seen a bit of a design fight over that terminal too with the town of Falmouth.
Absolutely.
So another thing that they're figuring their way through right now. This was the year or two in which the winter storm season inflicted some memorable damage. We saw flooding where we hadn't typically seen flooding, remarkable erosion. We had a couple of rounds of widespread power outages. This was back in January and March. It's looking back, they kind of all blur together for me. I had to go back through the news reports to pull these all apart again.
I had to do that as well, and it is amazing to look back in January and see the flooding that occurred in January and thinking back to January and thinking, wow, this is a really big deal at the time. This mm-hmm. is a really big story. Some of the stories we've already talked about already kind of topped that. And what also topped it was the storms in March, these nor'easters that came in and caused, as you said, a lot of power outages. There were heavy wind. There was a lot of erosion. Nauset Beach really took a hit. Liam's Restaurant, which is there on Nauset Beach, a snack shop, had to be torn down. This was something that was there for years and years and years. People really had a tradition of going there. And so there were real effects along the coastline in terms of what these storms did. The flooding you mentioned from the January storms was incredible, though, because it was happening in places where it hadn't happened before. Parts of Chatham were cut off. Provincetown, downtown, you saw some video of this water, these waters flooding downtown. Barnstable Village, there was massive flooding. So there was a lot of places where people didn't see it happening before. we took a look at some of that from the standpoint of certainly climate change. Mm-hmm. You know, again, a small rise in sea level, and you're talking about, you know, flood waters on any given storm kind of getting to a point where they might not have gotten before and topping over things where they may have been kept at bay.
And seeing more frequent and more intense storms, too, which I think has been the case recently and has been documented.
Yeah, I think they called it the four Easters in March when it was like four storms right in a row that hit us.
There was a moment there when 120,000 people were without power. The government, the governor rather, came down to the Cape here and really got an earful about some of the loss of cell service and how that impacted emergency services. People here without power and then without cell service. It really, the Cape delegation got involved in this.
And a reminder, you know, where we live. We live on a peninsula. So again, in other places where power can come in from different areas or where you can have cell service that covers things in a much broader scale, here on the Cape, we're surrounded by water, and again, we're beholden to the kind of the service we have very tightly around us. And when something goes down, a line goes down, it can really cut off parts of the Cape in terms of whether it's cell service or whether it's power or flooding.
This is our special year-end news roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times, Patrick Cassidy. We'll have more in a moment. Welcome back. This is our special year-end news roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of 2018. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. Patrick, offshore wind has been a standout story for 2018. This is the year this really seemed to jump forward and become a viable reality, something that's going to be shaping our energy picture going into the future. And the company most associated with this right now is Vineyard Wind.
Absolutely. Vineyard Wind won a bid to essentially sell 800 megawatts of power from an offshore wind energy project they have planned south of Martha's Vineyard to the state's three electric distributors. And they had to work out a contract with those folks in terms of that power. But that winning that bid was pretty important. Interesting enough, again, they had gone up against a couple of other pretty heavy hitters. I think Deepwater Wind and then a company called Bay State Wind, which was a collaboration between Ørsted, a international company, and Eversource, which is obviously the distributor for electricity here on Cape Cod and Martha's Vineyard, and had won out in that bidding process. But it really did speak to the competition kind of heating up for these projects. It's not all smooth sailing. This project is further south of Martha's Vineyard, and they were very quick and repeatedly pointed out, "We're not Cape Wind. We're not Cape Wind. We're not Cape Wind." They did not want to be associated with that project that had been planned for Nantucket Sound that foundered after they lost their contracts a few years ago, which caused a lot of consternation and people were not happy with its location. This is further south and south in the ocean off Martha's Vineyard. But where they were talking about bringing their cables forward, for instance, initially they were looking at the same kind of route that Cape Wind was going to be doing, which is through Lewis Bay into Yarmouth. And a lot of the folks in Yarmouth weren't happy with that idea. Raised a lot of concerns about the effect on Lewis Bay as a very sensitive area, ecologically speaking. They then shifted at one point during the year to Barnstable and bring it onshore at Covell's Beach. And Barnstable was going to reap some pretty significant amount of money for that, $16 million, I believe. And so that became a much more palatable idea for a lot of people. And seems like Barnstable was happy. Yarmouth folks were happy, although I don't know if they knew exactly how much money they were going to be losing out on. But in any case, they were really concerned about the environment there in Yarmouth. So that hurdle was surmounted. Vineyard Wind is still dealing with concerns from fishermen in terms of the layout of the turbines out there and how fishermen will operate within that layout. And they're dealing with trying to negotiate how that works. But a big deal for them. And then they, towards the end of the year here, picked up another bid, $135 million bid on a lease for another area south of Martha's Vineyard. It was them and a couple of other developers picked up these kind of last pieces of the area that had been planned. And this goes way back to the Federal Government Bureau of Ocean Energy Management planning out where these leases would be made available. That was a whole long process in and of itself that was, a lot of people said, very much informed by the Cape Wind debate and how they saw things go wrong with how Cape Wind was moving forward. And so we now have this area, when you look at a map, that's enormous, in terms of the size and where these turbines will be located. People who are worried about climate change, people who are worried about the environment, at least on many levels, say this is really a good thing. we need to look more towards renewable energies and away from fossil fuels in terms of our environment. We just were talking about the effects of erosion and increased storms on the Cape, and people are really worried about that. But there's always this process of how you look at other effects of large-scale projects, and certainly the ocean is, you know, part of who we are here in Massachusetts and part of who we are here on Cape Cod. So anything that's happening within those waters is something that a lot of people are going to come out and have opinions about, and we're still going to hear more on that. Their final environmental impact statement has been released for public comment for their first project in any case, and we'll also hear more about the additional projects that are being added into the mix. But it was also interesting to see the number of different companies that are kind of bidding on these projects, and that speaks to the competition really ramping up.
Well, you think about Cape Wind, when they picked up their, or rather, I'm sorry, Vineyard Wind, when they picked up their lease, it was for about $300,000. Yeah. The second lease they picked up for was $135 million.
Times three for the other two, so $405 million in total in leasing, which was the highest amount so far in the United States in terms of the cost of those leases.
And the potential this has for the whole region, really, if it's staged out of New Bedford, there's a lot of New Bedford's looking to see a lot of bump from that. So it's a story that, and also they're looking to begin construction, they say, Vineyard Wind, by the end of 2019. So this time next year, we could be seeing some of this construction going on.
And they even say they really need to begin construction by then because of federal tax credits that will expire at that point. So they're in a rush. They say not too much of a rush, but they certainly do want to get this done.
And of course, we have to talk about Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station. We are now counting down the last 6 months or so of operation for this plant, which has been the source of a lot of concern for a lot of people for a long, long time.
It has been, and it's still the source of concern for a lot of people, even as they know that it's going to be technically shutting down again in June. It had its continued problems this year. It had to come offline at various times. There were problems with feed valves. There were problems with a lot of things that we've heard about in the past, the temperature of the water being sucked into the plant. And so it had to come down. And I know our reporter, Christine Legere, who's been covering this quite a bit, did some math about the amount of money that they will have lost, basically, or not made because of all these shutdowns, which was pretty enormous. And you can see as this plant, which is more than 40 years old, has aged, that, you know, it's going to seems like it's going to continue to have these problems if it was to stay open. May have played a large role in why they decided to shut it down. They just didn't see it as economically feasible to move forward. And part of that process, though, is then going to move into decommissioning, which has been the next real big topic of conversation, and how you take a nuclear power plant and you shut it down, you take the fuel that's sitting there, which is really going to be radioactive for thousands and thousands of years. I mean, it's something that a lot of people, I don't think, necessarily think about. There's been discussion about a central repository for this fuel that the federal government is supposed to take care of, but of course, nobody wants that in their backyard. And so you're talking about maybe the fuel sitting on that property in Plymouth for many years. Cape Codders have always been worried about that plant because they say that if something goes wrong, the wind's going to blow whatever happens across Cape Cod Bay and here to the Cape. Certainly people in Plymouth, it's a little bit of a double-edged sword for them. It's an enormous amount of tax revenue for them, jobs, 600 jobs at the plant. But there's also obviously safety concerns from what goes on there. So again, they're in the process of discussing that shutdown. There was an advisory panel that's been working on that. It's kind of now moving into a stage where the state has a group that's working on some of the specifics and how that plays out. And the plant, as it's been kind of going through this process, has been asking the federal government, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, for kind of exemption, saying, well, we're not going to be open in a year, so can we avoid having to deal with this or avoid having to deal with that? Largely, they've been getting those, and the federal government has been looking at that and saying, yeah, well, you're going to be shut down. We'll go in another direction. It's also essentially being sold. The license is being sold to another entity that's going to be responsible for this type of shutdown. These shutdowns have happened before, but in a lot of respects, this is going to be wholly new for our area, and there were a lot of concerns about what that entity was going to really do. I mean, the more money they can save as they shut the plant down, the more money they can make, because they're they're going to be getting money that was supposed to be going towards this federal repository for this spent fuel, and they're going to be able to spend that. But then again, they can reap the benefits of whatever savings they see.
So this is this outside company, Holtec, that wants to come in and buy it. The deal hasn't been approved, but the idea is if they can save money, they can, in decommissioning the plant, they can make money for themselves, but people worry, well, that means aren't they going to be trying to do it?
Cut corners is what they're worried about.
I mean, least expensive way.
Again, long and short of it is cut corners. People were worried about the type of decommissioning because there are a couple different types of decommissioning you can pursue. So people are keeping a very close eye on that new company. They've been dealing with Entergy for years and years, who was running the plant. Now they're really focused on Holtec International and how it's going to handle the decommissioning. There was some good news as far as some of the opponents about how they were going to deal with what these are called dry casks and where they would be located. And they basically said, we're going to move them because some of the concern was, again, sea level rise, you know, climate change and where they would be located. So they were now talking about moving them, which a lot of people have said is a good thing. But then there were also questions raised about how long these dry casks, which have these spent fuel in them that still has an amount of radioactivity in it, how long they will last, what their lifespan is, whether there are problems with those. This is not going away. The plant will shut down in June, and we will probably be continuing to report about this in June 2075, as far as I can tell. I'll be a robot by that point.
Let's talk a little bit about the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe. 2018, I think, could be described as a tough year for the tribe, at least in its relationship with federal government and in its bid to move forward on building a casino in Taunton.
Certainly could. And on any, you know, given year, this would be the biggest story of the year. And just as we've been talking, Stephen,
down to number five or six.
Yeah, right? As I was preparing for this, I would point out and feel I need to point out that the reporting that's been done by our staff this year has been incredible. As I went and prepared for this, I looked back and the reporters, the photographers at the Cape Cod Times, I was blown away, and I'm there, obviously, dealing with them every day. They were amazing in terms of how much work they did.
And also because it's a very complicated story. I mean, there's so much legal winding in here, and your reporters have done a great job at unpacking that for us and really laying it out.
Are you talking about criminal justice reform? Are you talking about Pilgrim? Are you talking about Mashpee Wamp? It's all there. But with Mashpee Wampanoag in particular, Tanner Stenning, who took on the beat not a year or so ago, has really done a good job of really laying out exactly how this has been working. The tribe, as folks may know, was seeking federal recognition, got that, wanted to get its land into trust. It's a sovereign nation. And with that land in trust, it got the opportunity to build a casino. They decided that they wanted to do that in Taunton. And that's where the real problem started to happen, because the neighbors of that proposed billion-dollar casino in Taunton sued, and they went to the federal courts, and they sued, and they won. A federal judge essentially sent a decision by the Department of Interior back to the Department of Interior and said, you got to rethink this and figure out another way to describe this tribe as Indian. That was the definition of Indian was really what was called for. And for Mashpee Wampanoag, who are the tribe that first met the Pilgrims, they were blown away by this, that somebody would be questioning whether they were Indian enough or not to have land taken into trust on their behalf. And so the Department of Interior under the Trump administration, the Obama administration, had made the first decision. Under the Trump administration, essentially came back and said, yeah, we don't see this happening. We don't have another definition by which we think they can go forward and we can keep their land in trust. And so the casino deal is at stake here. The tribe says a lot of other things are at stake. This is 320 acres in Mashpee and Taunton, and they say their schools, their all sorts of things, their government building, their language program. These are things that could be affected by this deal. They are being funded or have been funded by an international casino developer, Genting. And at this point, we understand it's $450 million or so that have been put into this project. And Genting is essentially at this point writing that off and not seeing a light at the end of the tunnel. The tribe is hoping, and folks who are supporting them are hoping, that a bill that was put forward by Representative Bill Keating in Congress that would essentially say, we're going to say that this tribe deserves this land by law, federal law, and you know, no legal challenge is going to be able to overturn that. They're hoping that bill will take effect and be passed. It's got an uphill battle as well, but if that happens, then the tribe can kind of start the casino, building a casino again. If it doesn't happen, things really don't look good for the tribe in terms of their future,
at
least.
The tribe really pointing out that this is a precedent that the federal government shouldn't be setting, which is taking away lands that are already in trust for a recognized tribe.
Exactly. And tribes across the country have raised concerns about this. And there was a march on Washington. There was a march in Mashpee. It's something that has wide-reaching implications as far as other tribes are concerned.
Now, Patrick, some people say that Cape Cod is an island, as it is entirely surrounded by water. To get to the Cape, you have to cross one of two bridges, and those bridges have been the source of a lot of anguish and now perhaps of some hope.
Or you could come by train and cross the third bridge. But on automobiles, in cars, which are the preferred mode of transportation, certainly getting here to the Cape, the Sagamore and the Bourne bridges are the way to get on and off the Cape. They're old. They're 80 years plus old, and they're obsolete in terms of the design. They're too skinny. There's all sorts of issues with those bridges. You go over them, and it feels like you're going head-on to the cars coming the other way because of those different design flaws. And they need to be repaired all the time. I mean, these are bridges that seem to be in a state of repair every year. This year in the spring, they said they were going to have to be working on them for 55 days, and people lost their minds. There was not a lot of notice. They basically just said this was going to happen.
Not only that, they said they were going to work on the Sagamore for 55 days in the spring, and in the Bourne, and they were going to take on the Bourne Bridge for another 55 days in the fall.
In the fall, exactly. And this is the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers who's responsible for these bridges. And again, in the spring when that work started, traffic, of course, as it does when you take a lane away on those bridges, started to back up on the Sagamore, and people were, you know, went ballistic and sat in traffic angry. The project wrapped up a lot sooner than they thought it was going to wrap up. And so, you know, people were happy about that, if you will. But pretty quickly, there was a lot of pressure put on the Army Corps to put off the fall project and say, you can't do this to us twice in 1 year. These are our shoulder seasons. They're expanding. We're getting more and more people coming during these times. They don't do work in the middle of the summer for the most part. But they said, you got to push that project off. So they did. But the larger question is, what do you do with these bridges in the long term? And there's been a lot of discussion over the years of replacing them, putting in a third bridge. It seems to be coming towards the idea of replacing them. The Army Corps is studying that. They've had recent meetings to get public input, and that was actually something that was relatively new. And the state has now weighed in quite a bit, and the governor and his transportation secretary have recently said that they want to see that happen quickly. They want to see by 2025 a project underway.
But the state pointing out there when they say that they are not paying for this, that this is the bridge project is a federal project. It's the Army Corps of Engineers, and it's a big price tag you're talking
about. We're talking probably $1 billion is what they're saying, a B, not an M, in terms of the price. And yeah, they say we're responsible for a lot of the roads leading to the bridges. We'll do our part on that front, or they say they'll do their part on trying to ease congestion around the bridges. But once you get to the bridges, that's a federal issue, and the federal government has to take care of it. So yeah, they really are looking to the federal government to step up. There was some discussion along the way about maybe the federal government doing the work and then the state taking over responsibility for operations and maintenance. But again, this is all negotiations about a lot of money and a lot of headaches for whoever is in charge. So we'll see how it plays out. But again, 2025 is when they're talking about they're needing to do a large-scale renovation, and the state is saying we want to start actual construction on new bridges by then. So that's an aggressive time frame no matter what.
I thought it was interesting. One of the statements out of the state was that they are looking to expand the bridges too. If they're going to be built, their preferred option might be to see three lanes and obviously much wider lanes in either direction.
Whenever you talk about expanding the amount of traffic that can go over the bridge, a lot of people, you know, quickly point out, they say, well, you still have the funnel of the traffic coming in from two lanes. So what's that really going to do? Again, people with much higher degrees of intelligence as far as transportation are hopefully working on this than me, but it is a decent question, again, because you got to prepare the roads around it for whatever you do.
Another story from 2018 that we should talk about is the Mashpee car chase that led to the death of a young man, Kevin Quinn.
And this crossed into the town of Barnstable from Mashpee, there was a man named Mickey Rivera, 22, of Fall River. He had a passenger in his car, Jocelyn Goyette of New Bedford. She was 24 years old, and they were driving. Police started to chase them. Mashpee police, they followed them into Barnstable, and Rivera's car struck essentially head-on Kevin Quinn's car of Mashpee. Quinn was coming back, and this was really something that struck a chord with a lot of people. He was coming back from the hospital where he was visiting his young newborn child and his wife, who had just given birth, and all three of them died.
Quinn died, and the two people in the other car died.
Yeah, Quinn died, and then Jocelyn Goyette died later on. Mickey Rivera died at the moment of impact, it seemed like. So Rivera, Quinn, and Jocelyn Goyette all died in this accident, crash. And again, a lot of people had a lot of questions. Mickey Rivera, as we had talked about with Thomas Latanowicz earlier, is somebody who had a long criminal record. He was actually part of and involved with a criminal investigation into a killing, I believe, down in Fall River. Mm-hmm. And so he was somebody who was out, and a lot of people raised those same sorts of questions as to how he could be out at this time. And this only happened a few short months after the Sergeant Sean Ganning killing. And a lot of those same sorts of questions about the criminal justice system came up. There was a mistake, apparently, that was made by a prosecutor, because just before this, a short time before this, he had been arrested for OU. Why? And what didn't happen was his criminal record and the idea that he was out on bail essentially for this other issue didn't come up as far part of that OUI, or wasn't used as a reason to hold him. And a lot of people looked at this and said Rivera should have been behind bars at this time. Why was he out? So it raised a lot of questions. And again, the criminal justice in the state of Massachusetts is something that people will be looking at for a long time going forward. And these two cases, the Sean Ganning killing and the death of Kevin Quinn, are going to be a large part of that. Kevin Quinn was somebody who, again, a young family.
He's a vet.
He was a vet. He was somebody who, kind of checked all the boxes of somebody who was a, productive and well thought of member of the community. And there were a lot of people really devastated by this. In addition, the Mashpee police chief, did his own investigation into his officers' actions leading up to the crash, and found that they should have called off the chase, that it was too risky. And there's a whole process that police are supposed to go through in terms of deciding whether to continue chasing somebody at high speeds. He says they should have called it off. So a lot of kind of fault being found around these stories. But a lot of people are trying to figure out, well, what do you do to fix it? And I think that's an ongoing conversation.
That is our year-end news roundup for 2018. I want to thank my guest from the Cape Cod Times, the maestro, Patrick Cassidy.
Thank you very much, Steve. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening. I'm Steve Junker.